From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we want to get right to today's major COVID-19 development, the UK's approval of a vaccine, the first country to take that step, clearing the way for vaccinations there soon. As in the U.S., when a program starts here in the U.K., elderly residents of nursing homes and frontline healthcare workers will be the first to get the shots developed by Pfizer and the German company BioNTech. Pfizer says 800,000 doses are due in the U.K. in the coming days. The country has a population of 66 million. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who survived his own serious case of COVID-19, spoke in the House of Commons today.
I would like to pay tribute to and to thank all those who have made this possible. It is the protection of vaccines that will ultimately allow us to reclaim our lives and get our economy moving again.
Jason Beaubien is NPR's global health and development correspondent. So, Jason, you've been scanning the globe. Your thoughts on this milestone today?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a big deal. This is the moment we've all been waiting for, right? When the vaccine starts to actually be available to the general public, you know, supplies are going to be limited in the beginning. And, you know, we need to underscore that this is the Pfizer vaccine that we're talking about. It's just one of the vaccines. But it really is remarkable how quickly they've managed to get this from scratch all the way to the approval stage. And it's not just Pfizer. You've got these other ones that are in the works too. But normally it would take 15 to 20 years to do this. You know, a year ago, we hadn't even heard of SARS-CoV-2. And here they've done this in a matter of months. It's really, it's hard to understate how important and remarkable this is.
You using the real scientific name for COVID-19, but what's your biggest concern as the UK starts to roll out the vaccine, as other countries watch?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's going to be two issues. One is just the logistics. As I mentioned, this is the Pfizer vaccine. So this is the one that takes that incredibly low temperature for storage. It's minus 70 centigrade that it needs at certain points in time when it's being stored and transported. So logistically, this is not going to be an easy task to get the vaccine to all the different places it needs to get to and get people vaccinated. But it's doable, but there could be some logistical challenges. Second is going to be this concern that we're going from vaccinating tens of thousands of people during these trials to now you're going to start giving it to millions of people. And it is inevitable that after some of these people get the shots, some of them are going to have some medical issue. Maybe they were just about to have a heart attack. That is going to happen when you start giving this to such a large pool of people. And questions are going to come up about, you know, was that an adverse reaction to this vaccine? It might have nothing to do with the vaccine. But these are the types of issues that, you know, could lead to some resistance, some stumbling blocks, some questions about the vaccine in the months ahead.
Yeah. And just look globally for us for a second. Which countries have managed to control infection rates well? What lessons can we learn?
You know, some of the European countries have done quite well. You know, you look at France and Spain over the last month, they've brought their second waves down significantly. Ireland also seems to have gotten fully past its second peak. The numbers continue to remain really quite low in Africa. Places like Chile, they had a big surge in June, and then they brought it down to, you know, relatively low numbers, and they have managed to avoid a second wave entirely, like we've seen in some other places. So it's really different in different parts of the world, but there are definitely examples out there of places that have managed to do it successfully and keep their numbers, either bring them down after a second peak or keep them low.
Right. And what about the people who have been, you know, to be kind, stuttering? Here in the U.S., we're seeing huge numbers of cases every day. Where are the other trouble spots?
Yeah. So, I mean, the U.S. still continues to dominate this pandemic globally with, you know, one out of every four cases being in the U.S. But after the U.S., then at the moment, it's India, Brazil, Italy, and Russia in that order. You know, it is interesting to sort of look at this. You know, 80% of both the cases and the deaths are in either the Americas or in Europe. It's really been these two regions that have borne the brunt of this. You know, and even this week, Dr. Tedros from the World Health Organization said he's very concerned about Mexico and Brazil and the rising numbers there. So there are definitely places that are not doing so well.
Yeah. Well, we just have a few seconds here, but I think I know the answer to this question. Yes, the vaccine, you know, is coming. It's coming faster to the UK. But the virus is still winning at this point, isn't it?
Unfortunately, it is. This pandemic continues to grow. Even as we see it ebb and flow in certain places, the numbers continue to come more and more each week, and they come faster and faster. So yes, the news about the vaccine is very important to actually slow that spread of the virus that we're seeing globally.
But the virus is still there. Jason Beaubien, NPR's Global Health and Development Correspondent, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, here in the U.S., classes in Baltimore County's public schools resumed today, a week after a cyber attack forced them to shut down and hackers held the system's data hostage. This is happening at schools around the country. The attacker's identity is usually unknown. They often demand hefty ransoms to unlock the computers, and the FBI says we should expect more to come. Joining us now is Tonnell Hobbs, education reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, no problem.
So this attack in Baltimore, just the most recent of many, walk us through how these hackers are operating.
So basically, when the entity finds out they're being hacked, a lot of times the hacker has already been in their system for days or weeks. So when you come in the morning and you boot up your computer and you see the warning screen that says your files have been encrypted, and at that point, they've been in your system. They've probably stolen some of your data already. And it's just happening all over. It is happening, well, just all over the country.
So here come the hackers. You know, maybe someone on staff leaves open an app, or maybe they click on an email that was a phishing scam. Then what? The hackers come in, they lock up your servers until you pay a ransom, and then threaten to release sensitive data if you don't?
That's exactly it. Okay, so it used to be they would do this. They would lock up your servers. They would make life really hard for you. But now they're actually going and instilling data, and they're posting the data on their blogs.
What kind of data?
Oh, just sensitive stuff. You know, it could be social security numbers for students and staffers, date of births. It could be psychiatric reports. It could be discipline reports.
Okay, so this is going to be shocking to not only the school administrators, but to the parents who, you know, probably find out, holy cow, my kid's disciplinary records are for sale on the dark web. But then what happens? I mean, who at a school district is skilled enough to negotiate with hackers? And how are they handling the ransom demands?
Yeah, they're usually not skilled enough. And what they do is they bring in like a third party, or even if they have cyber insurance, they'll call their insurance companies, and their insurance companies will do much of the negotiation.
How much money are they paying?
You know, it used to be some years ago, it might have been $10,000 or $15,000. Now it's easy in the six figures.
Wow. So this is happening. Well, context is important, right? I mean, this is happening at a time when schools are operating with two hands tied behind their backs. They've been overwhelmed by the pandemic and their students and their staff at home learning. How vulnerable are they feeling right now? And is that part of the reason why they're being targeted?
Well, you know, they've been targeted going back a few years that I know of. But, you know, a lot of the cyber experts say it's just escalated now. It's also the timing. They realize that school districts are very reliant right now on technology and being online because of remote learning. Some school systems are just straight remote learning. So what they have to do, and what we're seeing, is they're having to even push back, you know, remote learning or cancel classes for the day. And for some of these school districts, it's the decision of to pay or not to pay, to not pay. Obviously, you might have to rebuild your servers, which you're going to be down for a bit. And to pay, then you're giving in to the hacker. So it's been a tough decision for some of these school districts.
Well, you're right. I mean, we've been doing these stories for a while now, but never have we focused, as far as I know, on school districts. And when I think about school districts paying a ransom, I have to wonder, you know, like so many school districts across the country, their budgets are stretched thin. It's not like they have a ton of money laying around in most cases. How are they handling that?
And that's the thing, too. Some of them do have cyber insurance, but we're even seeing now where the cyber insurance is not covering everything. That might cover the fees to hire your outside negotiators and your folks that would turn in the ransom money into cryptocurrency. But the cyber insurance is not even enough. So they're going into already squeezed reserve funds, and they're getting the money from there.
Meanwhile, Hospitals are also a target of these attacks increasingly. They're underwater in the pandemic. There's fears about the vulnerability of our electrical grids with hackers. Where's all this headed, do you think? What's the end game?
Yeah, you know, I go in the dark web probably every day, and I have seen just so many industries hit. Even today, there was an infant car seat maker hit. I don't know. It's obviously got some attention at the federal level, but a big concern too is that there's really no clearinghouse, you know, where everybody's reporting their attacks. So just trying to get your head around how extreme it is, you know, is difficult in itself.
Tonnell Hobbs, education reporter for the Wall Street Journal. We're going to link you to your story. It's fascinating and frightening. Tonnell, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
COVID-19 took nearly 2,600 lives yesterday alone here in the U.S., the highest death toll since April. Now, we've heard quite a bit on this program about lives lost to the pandemic. We think it's important, and we're going to continue to honor them. But today, a life saved. 44-year-old Jeff Gerson is an early survivor. He lives in New York City. We heard about him from our colleague Ellie Levine, who calls Jeff her uncle. Their dads are cousins. He was admitted to NYU Langone Tisch Hospital in mid-March in the middle of the COVID surge in the city. He had a high fever and a cough. The next day, doctors put him on a ventilator, and that is about all he remembers. He was one of the lucky ones to wake up, but when he did, a month later, he had no memory of his stay. He was in the ICU. Doctors rarely came into his room because it was risky. But he wanted to thank them and the nurses, what he thought would be a handful of notes. Then through medical detective work, he found there'd have to be over 100 notes. So he wrote one big, long letter detailing his search and his thanks. That landed him on the front page of the Daily News. And Jeff Gerson joins us now. Jeff, this is a story of survival. So take us to when that started, when you woke up, like, you know, Rip Van Winkle to a changed world. What did you think?
I felt a need to say thank you for the heroic treatment, and yet the circumstances were denying me that, and every morning I would cry in gratitude and wonder, why did I survive? And so part of my recovery, I would say more my emotional recovery, was to say thank you.
Well, in this letter that you ultimately write them, you explain that you began with your MyChart app, which showed you who ordered the over 750 blood tests, EKGs and x-rays that you underwent. You went to the insurance company's explanation of benefits. They provided first initials and last names of the doctors who had billed. There were 116 names there. As you said, this is an army. What were you thinking when you're seeing all of that? And not even all from Langone. These were many people had come from out of state.
Yeah. It was a bit frustrating, actually, that nobody could give me a full and complete list. I don't know whether it's because of privacy rules or because doctors, nurses don't want their email addresses out there. I've been interacting with doctors during my recovery and follow-up, and I said, you know, every time I would do that, I would say, can you help me figure out how to thank everybody? And one of them suggested that I call the patient feedback hotline. They would love to hear from me. And I remember making that phone call, and somebody on the other end picked up and said, wait a minute. I want to write down exactly what you're saying so that we can post it somewhere. Is that okay? And I was like, no, I really want names. I want to say thank you to each and every one of them. And while I appreciate that you're, you know, going to put my comment up somewhere, I'd really just like some names. So that was a dead end. The app was almost a saving grace. You know, I can't imagine prior to an app like this where patients have so much access to so much data that I would have been able to get that list of people.
Well, it truly is amazing because first you were one of 1,900 who tested positive, then one of 412 admitted to the ICU, one of 312 intubated, you know, something put down your throat so you can breathe. Then one of 77 evaluated for ECMO, then one of 27 placed on ECMO. This is the machine that makes your blood and heart work, you know, for you. the oldest of 11 who successfully came off ECMO. When you started tracing and breaking down this path you'd taken when you were completely out, what did that feel like?
Well, first I want to say that, you know, that part of my letter was meant to convey how lucky I was to have ended up at NYU, the hospital, because of the way they're doing research and trying new things and trying to be on the cutting edge and really help patients in any way. That ECMO treatment wasn't even approved by the FDA on an emergency basis for COVID treatment until 2 weeks after they put me on it. So obviously they'd received some dispensation to do it on a trial basis, but I was just trying to recount how grateful I was that all the stars aligned, that I ended up there, that they had the equipment, that they were trying it, and that I received that cutting edge care. I felt like it all happened maybe to somebody else, because once I'd come out of the sedation, I wasn't in any pain. I certainly feel more sorry for my friends and family who were following every agonizing development. I feel like they went through a lot more agony and worry than I did. I just lay there and accepted the heroic treatment that I got.
It's just amazing to read about it. You also mentioned a doctor that you can't thank. This is Dr. Sidney Mell. He also came down with COVID-19, a 61-day battle. You read Katie Couric's description of this. He saw patients right up to the end, including you, and he died. I don't know. That's just got to be stunning.
It is, and it speaks to just the heroism of all the frontline workers. And he treated me the very first day I was in the hospital on March 20th. I read how he was treating patients right up until the day he himself checked in on March 20th. So it occurred to me that I was certainly one of the last patients that he saw, if not the last. And it underscored for me that he was working right up until the last minute.
Hmm. Yeah. And then the heart of the letter is what you want to tell them. You tell them about your detective work and finding them, but then what did you want them to know?
Well, if I could, I'll read you a little bit from the letter.
Please.
You know, my COVID test came back positive the afternoon of March 19th. Around 8 p.m. that evening, a resident entered my room, told me they were going to intubate me. Was I okay with that? And I go on to say, all of you know much more than I do about what happened over the next 4 weeks. I only know about it secondhand. I didn't fully awake from the sedation until the morning of April 17th, and what happened in the interim is nothing short of miraculous. What I remember when I woke up that morning was seeing Gerson Jeffrey, 44 years old, COVID positive, written backwards from my vantage point in dry erase marker on the frosted glass door to my room. Soon that same day, my negative test would come back and the dry erase markings would be changed. But I couldn't stop thinking about how many of you saw that written on my door and still entered my room anyway to take care of me. I awoke to commercials on TV with montages showing signs outside hospitals saying heroes work here, but not even the producers of those commercials could feel the gratitude that I did. Throughout my remaining time in the ICU and my subsequent week in rehab, I couldn't wait to get home to participate in the 7 o'clock cheer. As I sit here 6 months post-discharge, ready to go see the doctor for my third follow-up pulmonary function test, I want you all to know I've made a full recovery. I'm not suffering from any lingering effects of COVID. I'm on my bike riding laps in Central Park, having rode more than 850 miles since being discharged. I'm able to continue raising my son, and I'm here to give and receive back the love and concern showed to me by the more than 100 people who followed my progress.
Have you heard back?
I have heard back from quite a few. I can read
Please.
You. This one is from a nurse. Your letter truly brought tears to me this morning. To receive a letter like that, knowing we made a difference, is such a huge feat. I'm so incredibly glad that you're doing well since your discharge. I wish you and your family all the best and hope to see you around the city. Another one was from a physician assistant manager. And she writes very poignantly, I received your letter and have never once thought any of my patients would remember us, let alone well into their recovery phase out of the ICU and subsequently the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I was pregnant in my first trimester when treating you, And while I was internally anxious and scared, your healthy recovery makes me realize that the struggles I had to go to work every day were 100% worth it.
Jeff Gerson, this detective work to find out what happened when you were in the hospital with COVID-19. And also, I'm sure you've learned since that not everyone who gets on a ventilator gets off. Something like 40% die. I can see that driving your research, you know, that gratitude.
Certainly, certainly. And I can't say enough about the team that took care of me. The letter was all about them. I never expected to be in the paper or even be on your show today. My objective simply was to say thank you. And coming as it did during Thanksgiving and as the number of cases spike, I hope at the very least it reminds everybody that there are still heroes out there, still on the front lines, still fighting to get the pandemic under control. And they often go without appreciation. And the point of my letter was to give them the recognition that they're due.
At last tally, how many hands do you think were laid on you when you were out with COVID-19?
I've received actual responses with names totaling another 17. So that brings the total up to 134. But I have to imagine that since there was no official list, I've got to imagine that it's at least double that.
Jeff Gerson, we'll link you to some of his letter at hearnow.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was very nice talking to you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, December 10th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
For the first time in nearly 2 years, civilians are taking a flight on a Boeing 737 MAX plane today. The demonstration flight, operated by American Airlines, will travel from Dallas to Tulsa with members of the media as the first passengers since those two fatal crashes grounded the aircraft for 20 months. Let's bring in Here Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. And Seth, today's flight designed to build consumer confidence, prove they're safe after the FAA recertified the MAX last month. So tell us more about today's flight and when we can expect commercial flights.
Yeah, about 90 journalists wearing masks as on any flight these days, plus the flight crew. You've got obviously pilots and flight attendants on there. So you add that all up and it's something like 2/3 full, which nowadays is a rather full flight compared to a lot of commercial ones, right, Robin? And Exactly. The fact that they're doing this shows that they are concerned about consumer confidence. Of course, now you have COVID impacting consumer confidence in terms of flying, as well as those MAX issues, the flights, the crashes, rather, killed 346 people.
Yeah, terrible. Well, and the grounding was a huge blow to Boeing financially. Pretty critical, I'd imagine, to get these planes back in the air. So, you know, how critical? And what's the sense that this is going to work? People will get on them.
Even more critical than before, because before, at least, you had airlines clamoring for the planes. So despite the problems, you just sort of had this natural inertia, you might call it, of airlines that just needed the airplanes. And now that's different. Now they have most of these airlines, too many airplanes. So even though they still want these planes because they're more efficient, they can afford to wait. They can afford not to buy new planes. So yeah, this is now a double blow to Boeing. We thought the worst thing was that they couldn't deliver all these planes that airlines wanted. Now they have airplanes on their hands that airlines don't necessarily need, even though over the very long term, look, airlines want to renew their fleets.
Well, and is that, just to be clear, is that they don't necessarily need it because of COVID, because so few people are flying right now?
Right, because demand is lower. So if you remember, yeah, Robin, when the grounding first happened before the busy summer travel season of a year earlier, well, airlines couldn't fly their schedules. They were counting on these planes. They count on every airplane to fly during a normal summer, whereas now there's just a lot of slack in their fleets. Yeah. And so they might not have the plane they want, but they have a plane.
Yeah. And speaking of the COVID-19, airlines are playing a key role in shipping vaccines. In the minute we have, last week, United flew the first plane carrying Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine from Brussels to Chicago. You know, of course, it has to be really cold. Talk about some of the challenges airlines are facing.
Yeah. And these are airlines that have pivoted, to use the word that we hear so much in so many different contexts these days, to really being more cargo carriers than they used to be. U.S. carriers in particular, an airline like United, which you mentioned, these airlines carry cargo, but it was all about passengers. During the pandemic, they've been specializing more in cargo. And now, yes, even as there have been questions about the role of airlines in moving people around the world and perhaps helping spread the virus, now a part there of the solution. And as you said, a lot of specialized equipment. This is not the same as loading your everyday suitcases onto a plane.
That's right. They got to be super cold for some of these vaccines. Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst. Seth, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin. Stay safe.
You too.
Yesterday, China successfully landed a probe on the moon in an area known as the Ocean of Storms. The mission? To drill into the lunar soil and return to Earth with samples. If it returns safely, it'll be the first batch of rock and soil retrieved from the moon in over half a century. Joining us is Andrew Jones, a correspondent at Space News. Andrew, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the landing yesterday, very dramatic. You've been posting video of it on Twitter. Describe what that was like, just to watch this happen.
It was fairly dramatic, to be honest. There was apparently to be live coverage from China, and there were streams up and running. But about 10 minutes before the descent of the spacecraft was supposed to happen, the feeds were cut, so we didn't know what was going on, if there was a problem with the spacecraft, or if the landing attempt had been aborted, or if just they decided that they wanted to cut the coverage. So we're in the dark for 20 minutes or so waiting to know what happened. And then we finally got social media posts from news outlets in China saying that they've done it. And it's only later that we got to see this fantastic footage of the spacecraft making its descent and landing in the Ocean of Storms.
Wow. So what's next? It's got to gather up this moon dust, essentially, and bring it back to Earth. How's that going to happen?
Yeah. So almost immediately after landing, the lander started drilling into the surface to collect samples from beneath the surface, and also scooping material on top of the landing site. So they're collecting in two different techniques, and they're going to collect around about 2 kilograms and maybe as much as 4 kilograms. And a lot of that has been done already. The next step is going to be even more challenging for China, as it's something that they haven't done before. They're going to have to lift off from another planetary body. So there's an ascent vehicle on top of the lander that's being filled with the samples, and that needs to launch in around about 24 hours from now. And then it needs to rendezvous and dock with an orbiter, which is waiting in lunar orbit. So these are very complex and challenging stages that China needs to go through next in this quite ambitious quest to bring back these samples from the moon.
So, right. I mean, Andrew, all that for just a few pounds of rock, and American and Soviet missions in the past have already done this. I mean, it was a long time ago, but what new value does this cargo have for China's scientists and probably for the world too? I mean, what can we all learn from it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the samples taken from the Apollo landing sites and the Soviet lunar missions, those samples are over 3 billion years old. So what scientists believe now is, based on observations from satellites in orbit around the moon, that there are some areas of the moon which may be much younger than those other sites we visited. So there are very interesting questions here. Why would there be volcanism, which would be creating these new rocks, happening in some areas of the moon and not others? And also, what constitutes those samples and how is that affecting the geology in the area? So bringing those back would give us a great insight into the history of the moon, but also then the solar system. So the other thing to notice about this is a very complex mission. So not like the Soviet missions, which came straight back, but they're doing a lunar orbit rendezvous and docking, which is more like Apollo. So this is also a signal that China wants to eventually, in the future, possibly put astronauts on the moon and bring them back, not just samples.
Well, and it's not the only mission that China has for the moon. What does all of this say about where the country's space program is?
Well, this tells us that China has a very long view of what it wants to do in space, and it has a methodical step-by-step approach, and it is making technological breakthroughs and has some rather serious goals for lunar exploration. So we're going to see NASA going back to the moon in this decade. It's going to be quite an interesting next 10 years or so for the moon.
Fascinating. Andrew Jones, a correspondent at Space News, thanks for catching us up.
Thanks very much.
And you may remember the final scene in the James Bond movie GoldenEye, when 007 chased a villain onto a giant dish antenna. The bad guy fell into the dish, and the receiver, suspended 450 feet above, fell on top of him and exploded. Well, the scene was shot at the giant Arecibo Radio Radar Telescope in Puerto Rico. And yesterday, the telescope really did come crashing down. No one was hurt, but just 2 weeks ago, officials had warned it would have to be dismantled anyway because two cables suspending it had snapped. Astronomers around the world are heartbroken by the news. Alyssa Goodman is a professor of astronomy at Harvard. Professor Goodman, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Good to speak with you, too. I only wish the topic were happier.
No, I know. And how are you feeling about this news? We knew the end was coming, but this literally just came crashing down.
Yeah, heartbroken is exactly the right word. I did my thesis, a lot of it, at Arecibo 30 years ago, but I have very fond memories, and it's done important work. In fact, the conference I was just on that I dropped off of to speak with you, the speaker Juan Solera was showing gorgeous, gorgeous data, recent data from Arecibo about our galaxy. And so it's just crushing, crushing.
Yeah. Well, what did the telescope mean to you and your research? I mean, what did it teach you?
It's an absolutely unique facility, not only because of how large it was and what kind of wavelengths, what kind of light it looked at, but it was a hands-on telescope when I used it. And so I used to have to go in there and take a whole bunch of coaxial cables and basically build the back end, build the receiver of the radio telescope. And I actually did the mental calculation, and it was something about $40,000 a day that the NSF was paying at the time for maintenance. And I thought, oh my God, they're giving this know-nothing graduate student a telescope that costs $40,000 a day to operate. But in the end, we found the first measurement of a magnetic field in a particular kind of region in space that's very important because it forms stars. And so that's the kind of thing that happens at Arecibo.
Was it as impressive to see up close as it was in the pictures?
Oh, much more impressive. I mean, we used to go jogging and walking around the rim of the telescope under the edge. And, you know, it's surrounded by jungle growing on limestone karst. And so, you know, it looks like something out of Jurassic Park more than the movies that you've seen it in. And it was a long, long walk or run. Think about, you know, that factor of pi on that 1,000-foot diameter. It's a 3,000-plus-foot walk around the edge. So it's a massive thing. I even once had the opportunity to help one of the engineers, Lynn Baker, go up on the structure you talked about, 500 feet in the air, and hang from ropes and try to get a pencil out of a dish had dropped it in. My mother didn't like that story about me hanging from ropes.
No, she wouldn't.
The telescope. Yeah.
Well, yeah. This sort of feels like a wake, doesn't it? We're laughing and remembering its legacy.
Yeah, no, I hope we can build something to replace it. There is this FAST telescope in China now that tries to do the same kind of work, but it's really not at the quality in terms of sensitivity and reliability yet, anyway, of Arecibo, and we need another one.
Yeah, I know you'll mourn its loss professionally, but culturally speaking, it was important too. I mean, my first exposure to it was through the movie Contact, you know, with Jodie Foster, who was searching for alien life out in the galaxy. I know you're a scientist, but does that part of this story matter to you too?
Oh, absolutely. Partially because Jill Tarter, who is the sort of real Jodie Foster in real life, is a friend of mine. And, you know, she's one of the people I've been communicating with on Twitter saying, what are we going to do, you know, to kind of make ourselves all feel better, both, as you say, you know, personally, emotionally, and scientifically. Culturally, though, I think some people don't know that it's absolutely essential to the science education efforts in Puerto Rico. There's a visitor center who one of the staff members at Arecibo worked very, very hard to create about 20-something years ago that's become absolutely essential in educating young people and adults. So something has to be done by the NSF to keep that educational aspect of Arecibo going.
I just wonder, like, does it surprise you that a telescope of that magnitude, of that importance, was allowed to get to the state where it would just simply collapse in a pile of
dust?
Yes,
it's absolutely shocking. I do not know how this happened. I cannot imagine. And the idea that 2 weeks ago people were saying this was unsalvageable and then it took only 2 weeks to actually collapse is kind of unbelievable, but it happened.
Alyssa Goodman, professor of astronomy at Harvard. I'm sorry, because I know this is tough for you, but thanks for taking some time with us. Appreciate it.
No, it's okay. Arecibo is leaving us a beautiful legacy of science, and hopefully we'll get something to replace it soon. Thanks.
Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger today called on President Trump to drop unfounded claims of voter fraud in his state. Yesterday, Gabriel Sterling, one of Raffensperger's top lieutenants, speaking from the lectern at the statehouse, said threats of violence directed at them, prompted by those false claims, had extended to a young election worker.
A 20-something tech in Gwinnett County today has death threats and a noose put out saying he should be hung for treason because he was transferring a report on batches from an EMS to a county computer so he could read it. It has to stop.
And Sterling told President Trump and Republican senators, you haven't condemned this, saying this.
This is elections. This is the backbone of democracy. And all of you who have not said a damn word are complicit in this.
Stephen Fowler is political reporter at Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Stephen, how did Sterling's words reverberate there?
So, Robin, what you have to understand is for much of the past month, Gabriel Sterling has come and done these twice-a-week press conferences. He's been very matter-of-fact, mild-mannered, getting into the weeds about how Georgia's vote counting works. And to have him come out and just so emotionally, angrily speak out against his own party and top leaders for what's been happening with these threats and harassment was truly a stunning thing to witness, because we've seen the Secretary of State face death threats and we've seen people post his address and go outside of his house. Gabe Sterling had police protection. We've seen, you know, Governor Brian Kemp thrown under the bus, but it was this, you know, average, everyday 20-something technician just doing a job facing death threats and a noose with his name next to it that really was the straw that broke the camel's back there.
Tell us more about these threats, both against the public officials and this young man, a noose?
Right. So we had the votes counted twice as part of a hand count risk limiting audit. And now the president requested a recount. And with that has come some unwanted attention. You know, I mentioned the Secretary of State has received threats. One of his adult children had somebody break into their house and turn the lights on in the middle of the night. His wife was receiving sexualized threats. And we've really just seen a lot of negative energy and attention around Georgia because the state, which has voted a Republican for president for almost 30 years, went narrowly for Joe Biden, and President Trump and other top Republican leaders have questioned that result. So you have a lot of President Trump supporters finding out these people's names and information and really just directing a lot of that vitriol. The Gwinnett County worker, there was a video posted online of him using a USB flash drive, transferring it from one server to a computer, and it was falsely accused of manipulating vote totals as part of this recount. And that's just not the case. And people went and found out his information and outed it, and now his family is being harassed.
This is all against the backdrop of those two Senate races on January 5th, two Republican incumbents, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, strong supporters of the president and he of them. The president is expected to head to the state on Saturday. So with that backdrop, what has this done to the Republican Party in your state? Again, a strong Republican leadership, and yet they're being attacked by members of the party.
It has really worried a lot of Republican leaders because the number one message they're getting from President Trump is to not trust the voting system. And on the other hand, you've got this dual Senate runoff that will decide who gets to control that chamber that is going to rely on every single vote being counted and as many Republicans as possible showing up in a traditionally lower turnout runoff election that's being conducted over the holidays. And so some have called it a bit of a tightrope to walk, but really it's a rock and a hard place. Many are worried that the president coming to town, and if he veers off course and starts attacking the governor and the secretary of state, that could be doing more harm than good in probably the most consequential Senate elections in the country.
But on the other hand, are Democrats standing back and saying, wow, the Republican Party in Georgia, you know, they're cannibalizing themselves?
Right. So, I mean, Democrats see this as, on the one hand, a best case scenario because fewer Republicans showing up to vote greatens the chance that they have control of the Senate by winning these two runoffs. But you have seen Democratic leaders speaking out, defending Brad Raffensperger, defending the integrity of the elections, and saying, you know, this is not right for our democracy to attack these things without evidence. And, you know, there have been some comparisons that saying, oh, what President Trump is doing is like what Democratic gubernatorial nominee Stacey Abrams did in 2018. But the big difference is that when Stacey Abrams did not concede in 2018, that she acknowledged that Governor Brian Kemp was going to be the next governor of the state, but then got to work on changing the system, versus what we're seeing here is a destabilizing of the system. So even if Democrats win this race, they're worried about the long-term effects on democracy.
Stephen Fowler, political reporter at Church of Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Stephen, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.